can you temporarily jump off a cliff? From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is the last day of 2012. Amidst the fiscal cliff festivities, we'll talk about one part of the government that is making money, and a lot of it. We'll also talk about record profits at OPEC, the cartel that puts out much of the world's oil. And prospective bosses can no longer make you log them into your Facebook account. Well, not in California, anyway.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
As we contemplate the increasingly serious prospect of no fiscal cliff deal today, we're beginning to talk in terms of a retroactive deal. Basically, we go over the cliff, but some deal struck in the next few weeks tries to make it as if that never happened. Gus Fauché is one of our regular guests here on the show. He is senior economist at PNC Financial Services Group. Hi, Gus.
Good morning.
A retroactive deal. How would that work, you think?
Well, the IRS could tell businesses not to reduce people's tax withholding, so their paychecks would stay roughly the same. Theoretically, the spending cuts would take effect, but the Obama administration can tell government agencies not to implement them. And so the damage from the fiscal cliff would be limited, at least in the near term.
Are there any short-term repercussions, though, if we do bust this immediate deadline?
We're likely to see Social Security payroll taxes go up, and so that would reduce people's paychecks. And also, we could see unemployment insurance benefits temporarily cut, although the administration could reapply them later, and so people would get that money sometime in the next few weeks.
We've got about 30 seconds left here. How concerned are you that even this deal, retroactive or not, won't probably fix the big issues here?
Well, I mean, certainly if we have this kind of deal, it's a short-term deal, and it doesn't address the long-term issues that we need to face, which is how are we going to pay for the retirement of the baby boomers? That's still the remaining big issue out there, and we're not making any progress on that issue in particular.
Gus Fauché, senior economist at PNC Financial Services Group. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
While our leaders in Washington peer down the fiscal cliff, let's not forget the fiscal fact that brought us to the edge. It's an annual U.S. government deficit of more than $1 trillion. But through it all, one government-related entity has been hauling in record surpluses. New data capture the scope of the profits at the U.S. Federal Reserve. And that got the attention of our regular guest, Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. Hello, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So chart the recent course of profits at the Fed. How well are they doing?
Well, in the last 5 or 6 years, their profits have roughly tripled, which is not bad. It's better than I've done.
And give us a dollar figure here. How much money are we talking about?
Okay, for this year, the working estimate by a fellow named Ray Stone, who is a great Fed watcher, is that the Fed will have made about $90 billion, up from about $35 billion before the crisis stuff all started.
And I know this is sort of central banking 101, but remind us, how does the Fed make all this money?
Well, it has this wonderful business model. You know, you keep hearing about all the securities it's buying, right? It's buying treasury securities and buying this and buying that. And it does that effectively by printing money that costs it nothing. So if you go out and buy $2 or 3 trillion of securities that pay interest, and you don't have to pay any interest on the money you use to buy the securities, you can make a lot of money.
So we call these things profits, but unlike, say, a private company, these profits are not going to individual shareholders or something like that. What happens to most of that money?
Actually, most of the money comes to you and me and the people listening to this program, the taxpayers of America. Stone's estimate is that this year the Treasury will get $87.5 billion from the Fed, which is a lot of money. And that's up from the low 30s before the crisis started.
Why isn't the Fed, this good-sized operation within the federal government, something that ever seems to come under the knife when it's budget-cutting time like it is right now?
Because the Fed funds itself. It doesn't get taxpayer money. It doesn't get appropriations. Out of the $90 billion or whatever that it made this year, it spent several hundred million dollars on itself. And believe me, they pay considerably less to the employees than Wall Street pays.
Alan Sloan is senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, Alan, as always.
Take care, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Well, on this last day, while we face the immediate fiscal cliff deadline, investors are feeling at least a little bit of optimism, maybe because those folks in Washington at least are getting together and talking. The Dow is flat at this hour, sitting at 12,938. The S&P 500, though, a few hours into trading this morning, is up about 0.3%. The NASDAQ is up almost 0.7%. Investors, if you're not sure just how to play this market right now, evidently Legos have been a solid way to stack up profits lately. The investing strategy was profiled the other day in USA Today. The trick is to stockpile limited edition Lego sets when they're in stores. Many of these tend to rise considerably in value, apparently, once they're discontinued. One Millennium Falcon set from 2007, to choose a kind of extreme example, is up more than 300%. The folks who do this aren't toying around. There are websites like BrickPicker.com dedicated to Lego investing. One investor in Memphis keeps his 3,000-set inventory in climate-controlled storage.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
After 4 years, that's an extremely long time as these things go, the Tribune Company emerges today from bankruptcy. The media conglomerate includes the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, 23 TV stations, and a big slice of the Food Network. Keech Hagee covers the media business for the Wall Street Journal. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
So remind us, what was so wrong with the Tribune Company in the first place that sent them into bankruptcy?
Tribune got really unlucky in that it was taken private by Sam Zell right at the height of the final years before the Great Recession. And then the Great Recession came along. They had a lot of debt, and newspaper advertising revenue just went through the floor. And so that was called a perfect storm, in Zell's word, and the company went bankrupt in 2008.
4 years in bankruptcy, that's quite a long time. What have they changed?
The company has been going through a really long and complicated restructuring process. It's gotten a lot smaller. It's lost a lot of its value. And there's a lot of expectation in the industry that they'll be looking to sell their newspapers now that they've emerged from bankruptcy.
Does anybody want them?
Well, we have reported here at the Wall Street Journal that Rupert Murdoch, our boss, is perhaps interested. There are some other people who've raised their hands about interest in the Los Angeles Times. Warren Buffett, of course, famously has been buying up newspapers, and he says he sees value in markets that are bounded and where there's not a lot of competition. Of course, the Los Angeles Times is in a big market where there is a lot of competition. Some people may just think that they see a bottom in sight.
So let's say Tribune Company gets rid of those newspapers. What's the biggest remaining challenge for them to try to prosper going forward?
They are looking to reinvent themselves as a television and digital media company. There's a lot of great story to tell about their television assets, and they're going to have to really put their eye on managing this transition to digital that the rest of the media is having to deal with.
Keech Hagee, reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The number of bank failures across the country has fallen during the past year, but still a conspicuous number of banks went under. Most banks are earning more as the economy recovers, but our senior business correspondent Bob Moon looked into why some are still failing.
From the peak a couple of years ago when bank failures totaled 157, the number that went belly up this year was down to 51. But that's still more than normal. Is trouble still lurking in the financial vaults? Randy Dennis heads DD&F Consulting, which advises troubled banks.
I think it's continuing problems. I don't think it's new loans they're putting on their books, but I think it's banks that had troubled assets or non-performing assets. There's still a drain on the operations of the banks.
Regulators have held out hope those bad loans might recover some value, but it's still not happening in some of the hardest hit places.
Things are improving somewhat across the country, but I don't know that I would say we're having a robust recovery.
The economy just isn't growing strong enough to save those banks.
Financial industry consultant Bert Ely says as time drags on, regulators could start feeling more pressure to put what he calls the zombie banks out of their misery.
Given that the regulators do seem to be dragging their feet, you know, if they have a change in attitude, we may see more failures next year.
Ah, if only those old bad loans could be forgot and never brought to mind. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
2012 was a year of record profits for OPEC, the cartel of African, South American, and Middle Eastern countries that sit on 80% of the world's proven oil reserves. Oil revenues for the OPEC countries look to hit an all-time high of $1 trillion for the year. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with me now from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So the global economy has been a little shaky this year. China slowing down, large parts of Europe in recession. Right. You would expect, right, that this means lower demand for energy and thus oil prices drop. So why hasn't that happened?
Well, yes, it does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? The average price of Brent crude in 2012 has been $111.50 a barrel, the highest ever average for a year, even allowing for inflation. The main reason seems to be Iran, concern that Iran's nuclear ambitions might provoke the Israelis into a preemptive strike, leading to a wider Middle Eastern conflict. David Battersby of Brokers Redmayne Bentley says that has pushed up oil prices.
Due to the political tensions that we've had, people concerned that they won't be able to get their supply of oil, then this has kept the price up and has meant that the oil cartel, OPEC, have done very well out of this year.
OPEC, as he says, has done quite well as a whole. Stephen, how do things look when you break down results among the 12 member countries?
Well, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates have all pumped more crude at these higher prices, so they've done very nicely. Libya has been getting back its oil production back up to speed after its civil war and the overthrow of Gaddafi. It's benefited from these higher prices. Iran, on the other hand, is the one OPEC country that has not profited from the buoyant price of oil. US and EU sanctions are biting. Iranian exports have fallen, and indeed Iran's share of OPEC's total revenues have fallen by a third over the past year.
Marketplace's London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard, thanks very much.
Okay, Jeff.
Many of us have heard stories. Maybe you even know somebody. Maybe you yourself have had your social media exploits seen by your boss or somebody else with whom you would rather not share those details of your private life. Increasingly, some employers and college admission offices have required applicants to hand over their social media passwords so they can go in and have a look around. But under a new law in California, that becomes illegal tomorrow. From Capital Public Radio, Amy Quinton reports.
Listen up, social media addicts. In California, at least, you will no longer have to feel pressure to divulge your Facebook username and password. Earlier this year, there were reports of college admissions officers asking students for their passwords that led to outrage and eventually to legislation.
These social media accounts are really private matters.
That's California State Senator Leland Yee, a Democrat who authored the new law.
It contains personal information. No one ever thought that this information would be then made contingent for admission into a college and university.
What you put on a social media site shouldn't affect your employment either, says Democratic Assemblywoman Nora Campos. She authored another law that protects private sector workers.
An employer does not have access to your personal photo album at home and does not have the ability to ask you questions on your marital status, who you're dating. Those are a lot of the things that people post.
The laws that protect social media privacy were passed with little opposition. They both take effect on January 1st. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton for Marketplace.
And finally, there has long been a certain mystique around the astronaut Neil Armstrong's words when he landed on the moon in 1969. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, right? Armstrong has said that he made that up pretty much on the spot, but that has been disputed. Armstrong passed away this year, back in August, but a BBC documentary that aired over the weekend offers a new take on the story. The documentary quotes Neil's brother, Dean, who says he and his brother were playing a board game in the days before the launch. Neil handed his brother a slip of paper that had this famous phrase written on it, just to see what Dean thought of it, and he told his astronaut brother that he thought it was fabulous, and so Neil went with it, I guess. And just what board game was Neil Armstrong playing just before heading off on his perilous first-ever trip to the moon? Risk. That's all for today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.